The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code media at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal. Pay for your ticket and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code media for $20 off your first purchase.
I'm trying to say more with fewer words and trying to let the game breathe more so I'm not analyzing every dribble. There's hardly ever a time where I watch a game where I'm not taking notes. I give referees, all the officials, I give them my phone number. And I've told them at different times when I've spoken to a group of officials that, hey, if you ever hear me say anything you don't like, call me. You know, if you think I was wrong on a rule you didn't like the tone of something I said, call me. And they do. Every time I get a phone call to maybe explain a situation or to say, hey, listen, you know, you got the rule wrong here, I appreciate it.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their process. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston, and this week our guest is the ESPN college basketball analyst, Jay Billis, who has been with that network since 1995. Jay is now featured on ESPN's game and studio coverage, including ESPN's Saturday primetime game of the week telecast. You see him all over that network when it comes to college basketball issues. He is also a very prolific person on social media, specifically Twitter, where he always engages with fans, answers feedback, makes a lot of interesting commentary about the NCAA, also gives you his Young Jeezy lyric of the day. So we're excited to talk to Jay Billis. He's obviously a very bright guy, an interesting guy, very, very opinionated, and should be an interesting discussion. I don't know how often he gets asked about broadcasting and about sort of how he sees the media as opposed to specific college basketball questions. So hopefully you'll enjoy this podcast. Okay, and as promised, let's bring in Jay Billis, who we've learned is in the beautiful city of Chicago, where, Jay, you're telling me it's unseasonably warm for November.
Yeah, it is beautiful in Chicago. We got this Champions Classic on Tuesday night, you know, where Kentucky, Michigan State, Duke, and Kansas all play. And usually you'd be here and it'd probably be a threat of snow. And you know, I can walk outside right now in shirt sleeves. It's global warming is not always a bad thing. It's pretty nice here.
Wow. Good statement as we head towards the 2016 presidential election, Jay. And by the way, if you're hearing this, it's very possible that the results of that tournament will far and away be completed as we tape this with Jay Billis, we should tell you guys, on Monday, November 16th. But the conversation for this podcast, as it always is, will be about broadcasting and process, very little about college basketball, I think. So, Jay, I want to start off with just sort of a general overall question for you. And that is, how, you know, you've now been in this for a couple decades. How do you determine if you individually have had a successful broadcast?
Boy, that's a really good question. I think if the preparation that we have put in lives up to the game, I mean, there's only so much that we can do about a good game. And I've always laughed when take, for example, that 6 overtime game we had years ago with Syracuse and UConn. Well, after that game, you know, we're all getting all these phone calls talking about what a great job we did and what a great broadcast it was. And we kind of looked at each other going, I don't think it was any different than so many of the other broadcasts that we do. It's just the game was so much better. People had a heightened sense of awareness. But I think after each game, if we've done our prep, if it matches up to the things that happen in the game, and our preparation allowed us to follow, to let the game take us where it's going to go, and we didn't try to overproduce or overmanage the game on the production side, that's usually when I'm really pleased with things. And I'm also trying to, and this has been a long battle for me, I'm trying to say more with fewer words and trying to let the game breathe more so I'm not analyzing every dribble. You know, that's been that's been something I've been working on forever.
It's interesting. How do you work on that?
You know, you just try to lay out more, honestly, and not everything requires requires analysis. And, you know, sometimes you have to remind yourself that, you know, people didn't tune in to watch a basketball clinic. They tuned in to watch a game. And when I go to games and sit in the stands, I might watch it a little bit differently than my wife does or some of my friends that, you know, haven't spent their whole life around the game. But that doesn't mean that that when I'm sitting there watching the game as a fan, that I talk about the game that much differently with my friends. And so, you have to, I think, keep in mind that, that it's not a clinic, and that's been something I've been continually working on. And you watch tape and you just try to listen, you know, is there flow to the game, from the broadcast side? And for the most part, I think we all do a good job of that. But at the same time, you're just trying to do better because, you know, people don't need to have an X and O breakdown of every little thing that happens in a game. And yet I think we all have to be a little bit mindful of that.
Jay, one of the interesting things about you is you've worked with a lot of different partners in both the studio situation and in play-by-play. You've also worked on three-person booths as well as two-person booths. So, given that you've done this now for, you know, like I said, a couple decades, working also, by the way, for different networks and companies, have you discovered any way to develop immediate chemistry with a partner? Because there are times, obviously, where, you know, you will have to do a one-off maybe with a broadcaster that you haven't done a game with in a while, and you need to obviously have some kind of chemistry with that broadcaster for the viewers, but, you know, it might be somebody you haven't seen for a couple of years. So how have you gone about, if it's possible, trying to create some kind of instant chemistry with your partners?
Boy, that's a really good question. I think for me, first and foremost, it comes down to listening. That if you listen to what the other person or the other people, if you're in a three-man, what they say, and you're not concerned about how much you talk or have an agenda for what you need to get in. You know, it's funny, we do all this preparation. It's almost, sometimes you feel like, well, I need to get this in. You don't need to get any of that stuff in. The game will dictate what you get in. And if you've got a bunch of prep in any game, you're probably only going to get 10% of it in anyway. But when I worked with Bill Raftery and Sean McDonough, you know, obviously you're not going to be able to speak as much as you do when it's just one analyst. And that's true for all three of us. So you have to pick your spots and you have to be mindful of styles and you have to know who you are and what your strengths are and what everybody else's. Just for example, if somebody in a game, I'm working with Raft and McDonough, if somebody gets a steal and goes down and does this crazy dunk, I don't need to jump in to X and O that and show exactly what broke down and how the steal occurred. You got to let Raftery go crazy on it and enjoy the fun. Like that's one of the areas that he's the best in the world. And so I'm not needed there. And so you just kind of let him do his thing. And that's what being a teammate is, I think. And same with McDonough, when there's a story to be told, just sit back and enjoy him telling the story. Cause he's as good as there's ever been at doing that.
Jay, as specific as you can, how do you prepare for a game broadcast?
Another great question. I spend a lot of time in preparation, but it's not just game specific. So if I've got Kentucky versus Duke, I don't just start 2 or 3 days before the game and then put together information on those two teams. I'm following the teams all year long. And as the year goes on, obviously the universe of teams that I think are really good and have a chance to be there at the end shrinks a little bit and sometimes shrinks a lot. So I'm always preparing in a way, but what I do is I prepare basically a game chart, which is a scouting report for each team. And it's funny, Richard, I don't look at it during the game very much anymore. So once the game starts, the chart is there. It's on the table, but I don't really look at it that much except during a break and halftime and the like. But the exercise of making the chart, I make it by hand. I don't use a computer. I have pretty decent handwriting, so I just write it out. And the exercise of making it, you know, helps it, you know, rattle around in my brain and you know, more sticks in there than if I didn't do that exercise. It's kind of a routine for me. And then I keep the charts with me. So sometimes during a game, I'll look back at an old chart. I'll remember something that happened 10 games ago and say, hey, they ran this 10 games. I'll go back and look at a note that I had. And, so that's kind of the way I've always done it. And I've kept up with that.
Jay, I want to ask you the same question, regarding studio stuff, but as Bet cues me off here, do you have a specific process that you do for the preseason heading into the season? You know, for people who cover college basketball at Sports Illustrated, for instance, we do a lot of scouting reports. So almost through osmosis, if you are, let's say, assigned to a conference, you have scouted that conference if you are writing a conference preview. Do you do anything similar for broadcasting in terms of kind of this overall study or preparation for the season?
I do. I follow because I do this year after year after year. And as you mentioned, I've been doing this 20, I think this is my 22nd year, if I'm not mistaken, 21st or 22nd. You tend to think you have at least a base of knowledge or a foundation of knowledge where you build year after year. And so, I've watched a lot of these players in high school. I get a chance to work with them I'm a skills instructor and have been for a number of years for Nike at these Nike Skills Academies. So you see the top players. And so I know them when they get there. And I have scouting reports on teams and players that I update constantly. So when there's turnover, I have new ones every year. The scouting report for Kentucky is a little different this year than it was last year, because there's so much turnover personnel-wise. But I don't go through the same process that I used to. I used to be probably a little bit of overkill preseason with the amount of work that I did, and I try to be more efficient. And the technology allows you to be more efficient now. I used to carry DVDs with me everywhere, and now I don't have to do that because I'm able to watch all my scouting stuff is web based. I watch Synergy. And so you're able to do, just take your computer with you and do most of that stuff via remote. It's a lot easier now than it used to be.
It's interesting. You've mentioned before that you're a skills instructor at Nike, and I think viewers appreciate the transparency. It does get to a fair question though, and that is, how do you sort of weigh when you are talking about players you've worked with or quote unquote Nike players when you're on the air, so that viewers don't think there's any kind of bias or anything like that, because you clearly have a financial relationship with them?
Actually, I don't have a financial relationship. They don't pay me.
Take that back.
Yeah, I don't get paid. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that. They give you like expense money. So it's kind of like if I worked Tom Izzo's camp, they might give you $200 for a week's worth of work. It's
right.
That kind of thing.
Like a nominal fee, basically, right?
Nominal. It's not even worth calling it nominal. It's so little money.
Right.
But the reason I do it is because it gives me a look at these players early. And so you're able to be with them up close, watch them on the floor through practices and workouts. And, I'd like to be able to tell you, Richard, that I do it in part to give back to the game and stuff like that. There's a component of that, but it's a little more selfish that you get to work with the players and get to know them. And it's an incredible amount of fun. And then I also learn from the coaches that I work with, because Nike brings in the best, people from the NBA and skills instructors and all that stuff. It's really a phenomenal learning experience for me. So it's not so much a promotional thing where you're saying Nike, Under Armour, Adidas. It really doesn't matter whether it's Fran Fraschilla or all these guys. We all work these camps. And I'm not going to speak for Fran, but I do it more for me than for anything. So there's a selfish motive because it allows me to get to gain more knowledge about the players, which helps me in my job.
You mentioned before your preparation for game broadcast. The studio obviously is different in that there's far more opportunity to offer opinion, far more opportunity for there to be conversation. Possibility exists for long form interviewing. So the preparation for that obviously has to be a little bit different. When you are doing like a college game day studio gig, for instance, what is your preparation heading into that?
Well, I hope this doesn't sound crazy, but I think the preparation that I do and that I think most of our people do is being immersed in the game. So I'm immersed in it year round. And so I don't really look at it like, oh boy, I really need to prepare for this weekend. This weekend's game day. I might do some specific things relative to a certain game day broadcast that we've got based upon the rundown that we have in the show, which is, just basically the outline of the schedule of how the show is going to go. But you know how it goes. I mean, you've got to be prepared for anything because you don't know what's going to happen during the course of a day or the course of a broadcast. So none of it, it's so little of what we do is scripted. I mean, I've never used a teleprompter and you don't do that. And you just kind of have to be prepared so that you can react to whatever happens. So there's some specific prep that I do, but it's more just being immersed in the game where I'm prepping all the time. There's hardly ever a time where I watch a game where I'm not taking notes. And I wind up using those notes later on. There's something I'm going to take from that game. I don't know when I'm going to use it, but I know it's going to come up. And so I take notes. I have a notebook that Reese Davis used to call the Bible, and I keep it with me all the time. And I have all my scouting reports I keep with me all the time. So I would say it's more immersion than it is specific prep for a specific task.
Jay, there's obviously been a statistical revolution in basketball. Obviously, you know, probably baseball led the way. We're starting to see it in football and hockey as well. But basketball, particularly in the NBA, the use of sort of analytics and advanced stats, it's really, really become part of the lexicon of the game. You see it in stories online, et cetera, et cetera. How much has analytics influenced your broadcasts, and are you one to use it during games, and do you see yourself using more of those kind of numbers in games?
I do use it, and that's another great question. I mean, that's where Dean Smith was so far ahead of so many. You know, I read his book, Multiple Offense and Defense, years ago, and he was the first I ever heard of that used the term points per possession to really study efficiency. And so what I have used it for a while now. I try not to go overboard on it. I think most everyone, whether you're in basketball as like a general manager or coach or whatever, or broadcasting, you try to reach a balance because the analytics can be really revealing, but the game's more than just efficiency numbers. I think you have to have a feel for both and use both. But I absolutely use analytics. I'm looking at them all the time, whether I go on KenPom.com or using Synergy. And I'm constantly looking at those things to try to get a deeper view into it and maybe to provide a little bit more of a revealing look at the game. Just for example, I had a game the other night where I talked about a player that when he is a catch and shoot player, when he's allowed to catch it and shoot without dribbling, you know, he shoots 63% effective field goal percentage. But when he's made to put the ball on the floor, his percentage drops by 30 percentage points. And so if you can use something like that, they go, geez, if they make them dribble. So people can maybe watch that, like how are his shots coming? You might use something like that, but it's kind of like before about it being a clinic. You don't want to X and O people death. You don't want to stat them to death either. You want it to be revealing where they go, oh, geez, you know, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Stuff like that.
You're listening to Jay Billis on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. We'll take a quick break. Be back after this. It's Thanksgiving week, and it's important that you know how much we appreciate you, our listeners, to this podcast. Time is the most valuable gift that you can give us, and we work very hard to make sure we are paying back your investment. We welcome your feedback, your questions and comments. You can get in touch with me on Twitter, at Richard Deitch. You can get in touch with my producer, Bette Marston, at Bette Marston. Thank you again. We really do appreciate you guys listening. Also want to thank FanDuel, one of our presenting sponsors of the show and the entire SI network. With our audience of sports fans, we have partnered with FanDuel, and that service is certainly of interest to our listeners. Daily fantasy is a much different thing than the old-style fantasy games. It allows players to draft a new team anytime, enter games for as little as $1, and instead of waiting for an entire season to win money, FanDuel pays its winners the very same night of their contest. If you're curious about daily fantasy and you want to try it for yourself, go to FanDuel.com, enter my code MEDIA, and you could play with up to $200 in bonus cash. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay over $75 million a week this football season. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. Go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use our code MEDIA, and sign up now. Here's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use our code MEDIA today, so don't get left out. FanDuel also offers daily fantasy baseball, basketball, and hockey. Daily fantasy sports are sweeping the nation. Find out why on FanDuel.com and use our code MEDIA. That's FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. FanDuel.com. Try it out today. Okay, back with Jay Billis. Jay, I know I've asked you this question in print, but I do want to ask it again on this podcast. Do you at all consider yourself an activist in addition to a broadcaster?
I don't think so. I mean, I realize that it can come off that way, but I think what I do, or at least what I try to do, is, you know, years ago I just decided, and it took me a while to come to this conclusion, but if I'm going to criticize and give my opinion on everything college basketball, the policy in the game shouldn't be somehow off limits. That I realized that, you know, my company, your company, we all kind of have partnerships. Well, maybe not your company, but my company, we have partnerships with the different leagues, whether it's the NFL, the NBA, whatever. And we also have a partnership with the conferences and I guess the NCAA for college basketball. But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't comment on policy. And so I do that. I give my opinion. And, you know, if I have an opinion on a rule of a game, I give that all the time. So why shouldn't I have opinions with regard to the rules governing competition? And so, you know, I kind of say what I think, and I make it as much as I can about policy and not about people, because the people are great and everybody's intentions are good. But when I differ on policy, I say so.
All right. You've probably been asked this before, but there's sort of a line of questioning I want to ask about your sort of the NCAA and talking about policy, et cetera. How often, Jay, if at all, do either you or your bosses hear from NCAA officials or even college administrators about something you've said that's an off-the-court issue as opposed to an on-the-court issue?
I can't think of any time I've heard from my bosses about calls that they've gotten. I'm not saying they don't get calls, but they do a great job of kind of insulating us and having our backs on things. If there were ever an issue, I know my bosses would come to me and say, "Hey, listen, you know, we want you to consider this or that." But they've never done that. I've never had anybody from Mark Gross, anyone, come to me and say, "Hey, we want you to tone it down or don't say anything about this or stay in your lane," type of deal. Just talk about basketball and, you know, kind of shut up and sing. Nobody said that. I do get calls from time to time from different administrators that want to talk about policy. And, but it's never been, "You shouldn't say that," or "Why did you say that?" It's more, "Here's the way I see it, and we may have a discussion about it." Just like, I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but I give referees, all the officials, I give them my phone number. And I've told them at different times when I've spoken to a group of officials that, "Hey, if you ever hear me say anything you don't like, call me. You know, if you think I was wrong on a rule you didn't like the tone of something I said, call me." And they do. And every time that happens, every time I get a phone call to maybe explain a situation or to say, "Hey, listen, you know, you got the rule wrong here," I appreciate it. And we always hang up having a better understanding. I think they have a better understanding where I'm coming from, and I have a better understanding of where they're coming from. And I always learn something from it. And it's never been anything but a positive. And that's kind of the way I feel with administrators. When they call, and it's pretty rare, but when they call, I actually think it's a great thing.
That's interesting. I didn't know that about the referees. That's actually really interesting. You've talked about sort of this notion of, you know, you by virtue of your position, or anybody in your position, you sort of are a publicist, or for lack of a better word, a little bit of a cheerleader for the sport, but you don't want to go over the top and be a flag waver and a pom-pom person, especially when coaches get into trouble, et cetera. So how do you navigate being an advocate for your sport, but not too much of a cheerleader, where you become nothing more than almost a public relations agent for the sport?
I think it just comes down to saying what you think. And, you know, people sometimes ask the question, how do you stay objective when you're doing a Duke Carolina game, given that I've gone to Duke?
Right.
And I tell them, you know, God, it's really easy. I don't care who wins. And people have a hard time believing that. And, you know, you try to tell them, well, listen, you know, like I've got a 19-year-old son who's a freshman in college now, and he's a walk-on basketball player at Wake Forest. And, you know, he's my favorite player in the world, but I'm not out there saying he should be National Player of the Year. I don't do that. I mean, I understand exactly who he is. I know who's good, and I say it. So when Carolina's the better team, I say it. And it's really not that hard to figure out. And so I don't really worry about those kind of things. And I don't worry about being a cheerleader. When the game's good, I say it. And when the game's worth watching, I say it. And when it's not, when there are things wrong with the game, I say that too. And let me give you an example. Like, the first game of the year, we had a game in Okinawa, Japan, Gonzaga and Pittsburgh. And, you know, it's our event. ESPN sets the event up with the United States military and the Department of Defense and all that stuff. And we had a dangerous condition on the floor where they had to stop the game because of the humidity. The players couldn't safely play in that venue. And, you know, I'm not going to sit there and sugarcoat that hey, it's our event. There's nothing wrong out there. I said, hey, you know, this is not good. It's like an ice skating rink out there. And, you know, you documented it the way it was to be documented. And so I didn't really worry about, hey, it's our event and I don't want to get anybody in trouble here or anything like that. You just said what you saw. And as long as I do that, I always feel like I'm in pretty good shape.
That's interesting. Along those same lines, you know, I personally, I like Dick Vitale. I think he's a really good man. There are things about his broadcasting I certainly disagree with and have written. And I think one of those is that he's a little too, in my opinion, close to coaches. So extrapolating what you just said, Jay, if something went down with Mike Krzyzewski where it was he's in the news for whatever reason, you know, just again, these are all hypotheticals, something about the program, criminality, et cetera. Given your relationship with him, given you played with him, do you think you could separate all that and comment objectively on a situation at Duke?
I do, and I have done that in the past. Now, I can't think of a bunch of areas where I've been overly critical of Mike Krzyzewski, but there have been times where, you know, my ties to Duke are pretty strong. I mean, I went to school there, and, you know, I've got a daughter who goes to school there. My wife and I are both alums. When the Duke lacrosse matter was front and center, I, as an alum, I advocated that the president be fired,
right,
based upon the way he handled that issue. And now, so with that one issue, he and I differed. I don't think we'll ever agree on that. But with regard to everything else that he's done, I support him completely. So, I mean, I'm able to take an objective view of things and to hopefully make the right decision. So I don't really worry about that kind of thing. It's more, I say what I see. And as long as it's an informed opinion, I feel really comfortable that I'll be on the right side of it. It doesn't mean I'm always right, but I'm not really worried about some sort of bias issue. I don't ever really think or worry about that. And I always feel like as long as I'm informed, as long as I've given it the appropriate thought, and as long as I say exactly what I think based upon the facts and the circumstances, that I shouldn't have anything to worry about. It doesn't mean that people are going to agree. Reasonable minds can differ on almost everything, but it means I'm after 20 some years, I don't hear a lot of bias stuff anymore. You did years ago. But I don't now, so I don't really think about it very often.
You're one of the foremost, I think, advocates for student athletes in this country regarding payment for their services, the potential power that they have. When you read and watched the events coming out of Columbia, Missouri last week as we taped this, what did you make of the protest by the football players, and what did you glean from their action specifically?
Well, I think in trying to link the different issues, very difficult because the issue at Missouri is vastly different from the general issues facing college athletes with regard to compensation and their treatment and the fact that they don't really have a voice or rights.
Right.
I recognize those are very, very different issues. But the power that athletes can wield when they have a collective voice and use it is very similar. In other words, what you saw that the football players at Missouri do with their collective strength and speaking with one voice in that situation, you could certainly see happening with regard to any sort of athlete's rights issue, whether it's compensation or the like. We call them revenue producing athletes in football and basketball. And so if they don't play, there's no revenue produced. They've got a tremendous amount of economic power. And if they decide to wield it, and they haven't yet, but if they decide to wield it, I think that it could be a game changer with regard to policy.
Does your gut tell you that in 2025, NCAA athletes, let's just specifically sort of, let's even sort of at a minimum start with Division I football players, Division I college basketball players, do you believe that they will receive some kind of wage by 2025?
Yes, but I'm not sure on the timetable. I think it may take a little bit longer, but I think it's inevitable. I think the die is cast and it's going to happen. For the life of me, I can't figure out how a multi-billion dollar business where everyone gets paid fair market value, including every other student, that athletes would continue to be the only ones in the process that are cut out of it completely and that get only their expenses. I just don't believe that's sustainable. It's been a long discussion, but as the money continues to go up, and it is going to continue to go up, it is not stopping anytime soon. It's not going to become a multi-million dollar industry soon and drop down from the billions. It's going to continue to go up. I think the tension, between amateurism and the commercialism of the game is going to continue to go up, and the athletes are going to continue to get more and sort of, it's not that they need to stamp their feet and demand more. That'll be the quicker way to do things. But so many other people now are saying, wait a minute, this just isn't right. And you've got the rank and file fans that are saying this isn't right. That didn't happen 20 years ago.
All right. A couple more here with Jay Billis. Jay, I want to ask you about your sort of some early memories in sports television, but before we get to that, I'm correct that your first appearance on television goes back to 1979. You're a high schooler. You appear on The White Shadow when one of the Carver guys transfers to an all-white school, and you played one of the white players, obviously. So who's the member of the Carver High team who transferred?
Reese. Reese transferred from Carver to Oak Ridge High.
Wow. So you're on the Oak Ridge team.
Yeah, exactly. I was one of the Oak Ridge boys.
Did you? Nice. Did you have any line, or were you just in the locker room sort of milling about?
We were woven throughout the whole thing. I mean, they had locker room, school scenes, shower, all this kind of stuff. But really it came from one of my teammates, the guy that I grew up with, lived right down the street from one another. His name is Matt Baker. His father, Dick Baker, was a coach and still is a scout with the Dallas Mavericks. He was in Hollywood. He the 70s, you could turn on your TV anytime and you see Dick Baker. He played, he was like almost anytime there was a referee in a basketball game, it was him. He's like an extra.
Right.
And, he'd be on the $6 million man or all that stuff. So he was the creative technical consultant, I guess, on The White Shadow. So he got us on the show, got our whole team on. So we just played the opposing team. And it was a blast. I mean, back then, there was no VCRs had just come in back then. So The White Shadow was like one of the biggest shows on TV. And so when we were on that, and I think it was 1979, we were all freshmen, sophomores in high school. It was one of the coolest things, I'd ever done. And we loved every second of it.
Yeah. No, Ken Howard, of course, is the star of the show. And Gwyneth Paltrow's dad, Bruce Paltrow, I believe, he either directed it or created that show. So an iconic sports show in the 70s. You at any point when Jay, when you were at, let's say, Duke, did you have brought, you probably obviously also had designs on playing either pro ball or maybe playing in Europe, etc., but at what point of your sort of life's journey did you seriously consider broadcasting as a profession?
Well, I thought about it when I was in high school. I was one of those guys that thought, my mom really talked me into doing some like forensics courses and public speaking courses when I was younger, so to make sure that I could handle myself without tripping all over myself in public. And so he got involved in some different, like, you know, I got involved in the drama program in high school, things like that. And so I thought about broadcasting long before I had gotten to college. And actually, that was part of my recruitment, was when Coach K found out I was interested in that, and almost every school did this. A guy named Chuck Howard had gone to Duke, who was a senior executive producer with ABC Sports,
right,
and one of the, you know, one of the broadcast icons, really. And so I got to know Chuck through the recruiting process, and his daughter Dawn went to Duke and got to know her. He gave me my first job in television. I was a runner, you know, kind of a gopher production assistant, and my first gig was the PGA Championship at Riviera Country Club in 1983. And then I worked at the Olympics, and it's amazing how many people I met, you know, as a runner that are still, you know, in television and have risen up in the ranks on the production side. And so that's how I got involved in it and kind of learned the business from the inside is being a runner.
Hmm. What was your, do you remember your first broadcast, the first time you were a analyst on air?
The first time I was an analyst on air was I did radio for the Capital Sports Network, and I used to do the Duke games on the radio after I got out of law school, and so that was 1993.
Hmm.
So I did games with Bob Harris and the voice of the Blue Devils, and then I did my first TV game in 95. Or no, excuse me, that was the first TV game was 94, I think, I did for Raycom, but my first ESPN game was 95.
Who is your? Do you remember your first ESPN partner? Who was the play-by-play person?
Yeah, his name is Drew Goodman. I think he's still out in the Denver area. And we did the Big South Championship game. It was UNC Greensboro against Charleston Southern.
Hmm.
And there was no bid on the line because somebody had left the conference and they dropped down in number of teams and didn't qualify for a bid. So it was championship week with no bid on the line.
Nice. For years, you were part of a job share where you would do the NCAA tournament for CBS. Were you still technically under ESPN contract and they shared you, or did you have a contract with both groups?
I wound up having it with both groups, but what happened was, as it was explained to me, I mean, honestly, I don't really know exactly what happened, but the way it was explained to me was, I've been exclusive to ESPN for I don't know how many years. It's been a long time.
Right.
So I have an exclusive contract, so I can't work for anyone else. So what ESPN did, I was told, was essentially trade me and Len Elmore too to CBS for the tournament for highlight restrictions. So, you know, they would get some restrictions taken off of SportsCenter so they could show more tournament highlights.
Hmm.
And so we did that for a period of years, and then I was told, you know, ESPN kind of pulled the plug on it. But it was a blast. I mean, that CBS blazer is awesome. Being able to walk around the arena, didn't need even a credential to walk around. It was kind of nice. And I really enjoyed it. Getting to work with Dick Enberg was a dream come true growing up in Los Angeles and having watched him when I was a kid.
As the NFL season passes the midway point and heads down the stretch, there's some incredible games that are coming up, and people are going to obviously want to get out there if they can and see it. And when you do, you should use the SeatGeek app and enter my code MEDIA. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free and takes less than a minute to download. Then you search for your event, find a great deal, enter our code MEDIA, and when you complete your purchase, SeatGeek will send you a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online, shows you the best deals automatically, and when you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket available for your event all on one page. They rank every available ticket with a deal score, show you a color-coded map that's easy to read. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. Store your credit card, and when you find a ticket you want to buy, make the purchase with just two quick taps of your phone. There's no faster way to buy tickets. So, to redeem your promo code and get your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app today and enter promo code MEDIA in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. For the NFL, college football, for the best concerts out there, use the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA. Do Jay, as an athlete, what is it like to be traded for highlights?
It was awesome. I didn't care. I mean, just to be able to do those games, it had, you know, it's easy to say it didn't have, the money didn't matter or anything like that, but it really didn't. To be able to be at those tournament sites and doing the games, it was just so much fun. Like, studio's great. I love being in the studio and love being at games, but there's nothing better to me than being courtside for a game. It's the most fun. And, you know, I realize like what we do technically is work, but it's never felt like work to me. I mean, we put a lot of time into it and a lot of effort, but it's never felt like work. And being at a game has never, ever felt like work.
A couple more here, Jay. Is there any possibility that could exist again, that ESPN, I mean, I don't know if they do it for highlight restrictions, et cetera, but is there any possibility again that you could be loaned out to CBS for the NCAA tournament?
I don't know. I doubt it, but given that it happened once, I wouldn't discount the possibility that could someday happen again. But I'm not counting on it. I mean, I'm realistic about the way the world works. So I enjoyed it, and I was very grateful for the opportunity, and I learned a lot. And it was one of the truly joyful times for me in broadcasting. It wasn't better than ESPN, I can tell you that.
Right.
But it was a lot of fun to be able to do both. That was the fun part, being able to do both.
Yeah, I remember that, watching you as a viewer, and I really liked it. And I understand about sort of competitiveness, and you want to keep your talent in, sort of under your aegis. But I've always been one who wanted to see stuff like that happen. So when that happened for you, I thought it was good for all parties. I'm always one who thinks that if Barkley and Vital can get a game together, which they've always talked about, whether it's on Turner or ESPN, that ultimately benefits both parties in promotion. But, you know, I also understand, these are my words, I also understand that management in a lot of places, generally speaking, doesn't want its talent to work elsewhere. So we'll see if that happens for Jay again one day. All right, Jay, we'll finish up with social media and Twitter, because your Twitter feed, of course, Jay, is, it's a source of fascination for thousands, I think, out there. So first off, do you have a specific Twitter philosophy?
It's evolved. I certainly didn't when I first started, and that probably led to some of the stuff I do now, because I was too dumb to figure it out. But I've just kind of enjoyed the heck out of it. It allows me to communicate directly with people who are, you know, kind of fans of the game or fans of anything. And to have that immediate interaction has been really fun, and it's been enlightening. Like, if people come up to me on the street, which happens from time to time, I mean, I stop and talk to them. If I'm not in a gigantic hurry, I do that. You know, I'm a normal person like everybody else. So when it happens on Twitter, that's a really easy and fun interaction. So that's been the best part of it for me, is you can kind of show a different side of your personality, have a little more fun. And that's the way I've treated it. I try to have fun. I try to be informative. And I try to interact with as many people as I can without it kind of taking over my day.
At the moment, the Lacy's Legacy is your sole follow, or that's the sole person or sole group you're following. Will that number ever change from one in the following category?
Oh, I'm sure it will. I mean, and that's one of the things where I was so dumb when I started Twitter. I just didn't kind of get it. I didn't understand that what a great source of information Twitter was or could be. So I didn't understand the following thing or mentions or all that stuff. So I didn't follow anybody for a period of time, and I started getting kind of criticized for it. And so I made a joke out of it and kind of said, well, if they're not going to, you know, if Twitter's not going to let me follow myself, what's the point? That kind of thing. It had some fun with it. So I kind of used that as a running joke. And then a few years ago, when I found out through Tom Izzo about Lacey Holdsworth, I followed her during the NCAA tournament. And for some reason, because it was my first follow, that garnered some attention. And it I think, made the story, got a few more people to notice it. And that was a really good thing. And it was an incredibly touching story. She's a wonderful, wonderful little girl and a wonderful person. And she passed away, sadly and tragically. But you know, I've kept following her, and So that's the only follow I have. And I don't know that that'll ever change, but we'll see.
Is there somewhere like in the social media sphere, like a secret, like, you know, Frank Billistein account somewhere that is indeed Jay Billis or something like that?
Not yet, although I should do that. I should have a separate account, but I've never really pursued that. I troll around Twitter to find things I'm interested in. I just go to, you know, different people's pages that I know I can find something interesting and kind of do it that way. I do have a routine. It's kind of like, you know, in the old days, people would read different newspapers and all that. I have a routine of things I look at, you know, every morning to kind of get, you know, get myself acclimated and understanding what's going on. I'm not crazy about the idea of having alerts come across my phone every 5 seconds.
Right.
So I don't do that kind of thing. I'm not dying lousy to be the first to know everything. But I certainly don't want to be the last. So I try to keep the right balance there of being able to live my life without having to know, you know, hey, somebody just sprained their ankle in Lithuania. I'll be okay if I find that out, you know, 20 minutes after the first person.
Now, famously, as people who follow you know that, generally speaking, most mornings, maybe it's every morning, in fact, that you will tweet out a lyric from Jeezy or Young Jeezy. And if I'm correct about this, Jay, I believe last year you two finally met in person. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's almost 2 years ago now. We met in New York City. Vibe magazine set it up, and it was a little bit of an ambush, but I kind of had an inkling of what was going on, but it was great. We had a really good time, and yeah, I got a chance to meet him and meet some of his people, and so that was really a thrill. It was a lot of fun.
Did he he clearly was aware of the fact that you were sending these lyrics out every morning. What was his did he hopefully considered it like an homage, and like he was hopefully happy with the fact that you were promoting his brand, so to speak?
Oh yeah, no question. And they've been like, he's been really kind to me. You know, there have been a couple different things that have come out, and he would get in touch with me, saying, "Hey, do you want to be the first one to put this out?" And I said, "Geez, I'd love to." You know, kind of fun for me. But you know, I'm a fan of music in general, and Jeezy's not the only thing I listen to, but this thing has kind of taken on a life of its own, and it's been a lot of fun for me. And you know, hopefully he does, you know, think it's a flattering for him, but I don't think he spends a whole lot of time worried about it.
I'd like to get you on one of those albums, Jay, maybe a little backup singer or something like that.
I don't think that, I don't think the listening public would like that, but there, you know, there has been a mention on a rap song or two about this, and it's been kind of cool.
I like that. All right. And then finally, Jay, you, we asked this of a lot of our guests just because it's interesting, gives a little insight into what they might be thinking about broadcasting-wise. Obviously, you've had very, very high-profile college basketball assignments, but if you and ESPN obviously could offer this possibility, just given how many rights that they have, is there a sport out there that you would love, even if it's just a one-off, to broadcast one day before your career is over, and what would that be and why?
There's not another sport that I'm dying to do. Because I love basketball so much. And I mean, I've said this, it's easy to say because I'll never have to worry about it. But if ESPN came to me and offered me double the money to do another sport, I wouldn't take it. I want to do basketball. It's what I love most. But I mean, I'm a huge baseball fan. I love football. I mean, I would love to do those things, but I would get exposed as being nothing more than a fan. Like, you know, the most fans probably know more about those sports than I do, but I love watching them. There's nothing that I would say, boy, I would love to broadcast that. I would just love to be there. Like I want to go to Wimbledon, and I want to go to a World Cup final, and I've never been to the Super Bowl, you know, stuff like that. I would love to do those things, but I think I would love to do them as a fan more so than a broadcaster. Cause I'd feel too much of a responsibility to know what I'm talking about, and I just wouldn't.
Yeah, well, certainly Wimbledon. You could talk to your bosses on that one because they should have some seats there. Super Bowl may be a little trickier. Do you have a baseball team, Jay, that you've rooted for over the years?
Yeah, I grew up in Los Angeles, so I'm a gigantic Dodger fan, and spent my younger years totally in love with the Dodgers. And I mean, I knew who was playing in Albuquerque and who was coming up, and I don't have the brain power to be able to follow it like I used to. So I'm not anywhere near as up on it as I used to be, but I still, you know, heck, I got a Dodger hat on right now. I mean, I'm a huge Dodger fan.
Zach Greinke coming back, or is you think he's gone?
I hope so. I mean, the pitching is what I've enjoyed most about watching the Dodgers. And, you know, I remember got a chance to see Magic Johnson at this Champions Classic a couple years ago when he first got with the Dodgers, and that's all I said. That's to him was, you know, make sure you keep getting pitchers, because the Dodgers were the whole franchise was built on pitching back from the Sandy Koufax, Don Drysdale, Don Duke, all that stuff. And I think pitching is where the great franchises and the great teams are. It's where everything starts in baseball.
All right, Jay, final question. I'm gonna end it on a college basketball question, just so we can tie it all up, because I'm interested in this guy and interested in your take on him. Ben Simmons is the LSU freshman who's been getting an incredible amount of attention this year, and obviously a lot of attention because I think people are starting to project what kind of player he may or may not be in the NBA. I'm guessing that you've seen him, if nothing else, on tape. Maybe you've seen him live as well. What is your assessment of this guy, and what potentially in terms of a ceiling do you project for the NBA?
Well, I have seen him live. I spent several days watching him this last summer at the Nike Basketball Academy, and he's special. I mean, he is absolutely special. He's got a feel for the game that you can see, an intelligence level and a vision of the game that just not many people have. He's an extraordinary passer. You know, he's big. He can really defend. That's one thing I think he's been underrated in. Like, he can guard just about anybody when he puts his mind to it, and he can play almost any position on the floor. I don't want to quite say he's a savant, but he's in that realm. And, you know, he's not as good as LeBron, but nobody else that I've seen is. But he's crazy good. And if you had the first pick today, I don't see a whole lot of players jumping anywhere near him in line. I think he'd be the first pick.
Interesting. All right, well, watch him this year at LSU. All right, the guest has been Jay Billis, the fine ESPN college basketball analyst. You can see him on the Saturday Night Game of the Week. You also see him, obviously, on College Basketball Studio Work and SportsCenter throughout ESPN. You probably hear him occasionally on ESPN Radio as well. And we highly recommend his Twitter feed, which is always interesting and provocative. And when there's a college issue of note, an issue that really involves player compensation and other things regarding the NCAA, Jay Billis is one of the first people I go to see his take. So we always appreciate that. Jay Billis, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Oh, it was fun. Thanks for having me, Richard. Appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio as we wrap up. Our thanks to Jay Billis. I would say calling in from Chicago, but we called him as he travels throughout the states this year for college basketball. You know, Billis is certainly, you made the argument, the best college basketball analyst out there. It's all subjective, but he's certainly, he's really bright and interesting, and I was glad that he took the time to talk to us. But, you know, he gave you a lot of interesting stuff about his process and how he does it. The thing I guess I'm struck with at the end, and, you know, we don't really talk about a lot of sort of like the X's and O's and nuts and bolts of sports, but he gave Ben Simmons an incredible evaluation. This makes me want to go see that guy play.
Yeah, seriously, I'm going to have to catch an LSU game sometime.
What struck you about that conversation, Beth?
I'm most fascinated by, I don't know, he didn't talk about it much, but I feel like I'm most fascinated by the fact that he also has a law degree.
We didn't get into that.
I feel like people who go through the rigors of law school, and he went to Duke, which is no joke, but Duke is no joke of a law school. And I feel like if you go through the rigors of school, you're going to want to go into practice at some point. And, you know, he
did for a while.
He did.
Yeah,
but,
I don't think he's practicing at the moment. But, I mean, he has maintained an office in Charlotte for a long time, and he has practiced in the past.
Right. But I think it's interesting that most people tend to focus on that full time, whereas he now has this completely different career. So, I don't know. I found that fully interesting. And I think I also like his scouting reports too. I think that's a good way. I bet he updates them as he goes throughout the season, and it's just kind of a good way for him to keep tabs on all the different teams. I can only imagine if he keeps his scouting reports, he probably has, you know, all kind has stacks of these papers filed away somewhere. I'd love to go and take a look at those at some point.
Yeah, and he was, it's interesting to get his sort of mindset on how he approaches the notion of cheerleading versus objectivity, how he approaches the Duke thing, which obviously he's been getting for a long time. But he, you know, Jay Billis has, you know, ESPN's very fortunate because he has really provided them with an analyst who can take people behind and beyond the game, I should say. It's very easy just to say, you know, this freshman, this sophomore, this junior is going to be really good. Here's why. But he's like he really has become the media voice above all when it comes to, you know, NCAA issues, player compensation, et cetera. Very valuable to have a smart guy in that position as ESPN does with Billis.
And he takes it incredibly seriously as well. He was saying that he helps out with these basketball camps for his own
gives
purpose.
Refs his numbers.
Gives refs his numbers. I thought that was great as well. You know, he's clearly very open to criticism, and he wants to be the most knowledgeable person in the sport. He said that, you know, there's no other sport he would want to go and broadcast because he's, you know, he'd be afraid that he wasn't as, you know, well-versed on the sport or on the players as he should be. So he clearly likes to be very well-prepared when he goes into the booth. And I also found it interesting how he kind of described the dynamic of working with other players. He said, you know, it's a team sport when you're in the booth. You need to, you know, give other guys their time, know where your partners excel, and, know where you excel and where you should come in. And I think all that together really helps create a great broadcast.
All right. We thank Jay Billis for his time. I'm not sure when you guys are going to listen to this, but happy Thanksgiving from Bet and I, if you're listening before or after. The previous podcast's guests have been Andres Cantor and Jalen Rose, Jim Miller on the sad dissolution of Grantland, Jeff Van Gundy, the fine ESPN NBA broadcaster, Andres Cantor, of course, the Telemundo and NBC soccer announcer, and we will have some good guests coming up after Thanksgiving. No announcements at the moment, but we'll try maybe time to get maybe some print side people. We haven't had one in a while, so there are a lot of, you know, never going to run out of guests. So hopefully we'll come up with some interesting people. Please continue to support this podcast, and we thank those who have on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud. If you go to Sports Illustrated, si.com/podcasts, you can find all the SI podcasts, and please check them out. My thanks, as always, to Panoply and Slate, executive producer Dan Bloom. For producer Bette Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.